I think most of the preschools do things like this these days, Cecilia had said, but her mother had been too busy exclaiming over Sam's finger-painted self-portrait.
Imagine, Mum, said Esther, if we kids were visiting Grandma in West Berlin for the weekend when the wall went up and you and Dad were stuck in East Berlin. You'd have to say to us, stay at Grandma's place, kids. Don't come back. For your freedom.
That's awful, said Cecilia.
I'd still go back to Mummy, said Polly. Grandma makes you eat peas. It's history, Mum, said Esther. It's what actually happened. Everyone got separated. They didn't care. Look, these people are holding up their babies to show their relatives on the other side.
I really can't take my eyes off the road, sighed Cecilia. Thanks to Esther, Cecilia had spent the last 6 months imagining herself scooping up drowning children from the icy waters of the Atlantic while the Titanic sunk. Now she was going to be in Berlin, separated from her children by the wall.
When does Daddy get back from Chicago? Asked Polly.
Friday morning.
Cecilia smiled at Polly in the rear vision mirror, grateful for the change of subject.
He's coming back on Good Friday. It will be a very good Friday because Daddy will be back.
There was a disapproving silence in the back seat. Her daughters tried not to encourage deeply uncool talk. They were right in the middle of their usual after-school frenzy of activity. Cecilia had just dropped Isabel at the hairdresser, and now they were on their way to Polly's ballet and Esther's speech therapy. Esther's barely perceptible lisp, which Cecilia found adorable, was apparently unacceptable in today's world. After that, it would be rush, rush, rush to get dinner prepared and homework and reading done before her mother came over to watch the children while Cecilia went off to do a Tupperware party.
I have another secret to tell Daddy, said Polly, when he comes home. One man tried to abseil out of his apartment window, and the firemen in West Berlin tried to catch him with a safety net, but they missed. And he died. My secret is that I don't want a pirate party anymore, said Polly.
He was 30, said Esther, so I guess he'd lived a pretty good life already.
What? Said Cecilia.
I said he was 30, said Esther, the man who died.
Not you, Polly. A red traffic light loomed, and Cecilia slammed her foot on the brake. The fact that Polly no longer wanted a pirate party was breathtakingly insignificant in comparison to that poor man, 30, crashing to the ground for the freedom that Cecilia took for granted, but right now she couldn't pause to honour his memory because a last-minute change of party theme was unacceptable. That's what happened when you had freedom. You lost your mind over a pirate party.
Polly?
Cecilia tried to sound reasonable, rather than psychotic.
We've sent out the invitations. You're having a pirate party. You asked for a pirate party. You're getting a pirate party.
A non-refundable deposit had been paid to Penelope the singing and dancing pirate, who certainly charged like a pirate.
It's a secret just for Daddy, said Polly.
Not for you. Fine, but I'm not changing the party.
She wanted the pirate party to be perfect. For some reason, she particularly wanted to impress that Tess O'Leary. Cecilia had an illogical attraction to enigmatic, elegant people like Tess. Most of Cecilia's friends were talkers. Their voices overlapped in their desperation to tell their stories.
I've always hated vegetables. The only vegetable my child will eat is broccoli.
My kid loves raw carrots.
I love raw carrots.
You had to jump right in without waiting for a pause in the conversation because otherwise you'd never get your turn. But women like Tess didn't seem to have the same need to share the ordinary facts of their lives, and that made Cecilia desperate to know them. Does her kid like broccoli? She'd ponder. She'd talked too much when she'd met Tess and her mother after Sister Ursula's funeral this morning. Babbled. Sometimes she could hear herself doing it. Oh, well. Cecilia listened to the tinny sound of voices shouting something passionate and German from the YouTube video Esther was watching on the iPad. It was extraordinary how tumultuous historical moments could be replayed right here in this ordinary moment as she drove down the Pacific Highway towards Hornsby. And yet, at the same time, it gave Cecilia a hazy sense of dissatisfaction. She longed to feel something momentous. Sometimes her life seemed so little. Did she want something calamitous to happen, like a wall being built across her city so she could appreciate her ordinary life? Did she want to be a tragic figure like Rachel Crowley? Rachel seemed almost disfigured by the terrible thing that had happened to her daughter, so that Cecilia sometimes had to force herself not to look away, as if she was a Burns victim, not a perfectly pleasant-looking, well-groomed woman with good cheekbones. Is that what you want, Cecilia? Some nice, big, exciting tragedy? Of course she didn't. The German voices from Esther's computer tickled irritatingly at her ear. Can you please turn that off? Cecilia said to Esther. It's distracting. Just let me turn it off. Couldn't one of you children just once do what I ask the first time without negotiating? Just once? The sound went off. In the rear vision mirror, she saw Polly raise her eyebrows and Esther shrug and lift her palms. What's with her? No idea. Cecilia could remember similar silent conversations with Bridget in the back of her mother's car. Sorry, said Cecilia humbly after a few seconds. I'm sorry, girls. I'm just worried that your father is lying to me about something. In need of sex. Wishing I hadn't babbled on the way I did to Tess O'Leary in the schoolyard this morning. Perimenopausal? Missing Daddy, she finished. It will be nice when he's home from America, won't it? He'll be so happy to see you girls. Yeah, he will, sighed Polly. She paused. And Isabel. Of course, said Cecilia. Isabel, too. Daddy looks at Isabel a funny way, said Polly conversationally. That was way out of left field. What do you mean? Asked Cecilia. Sometimes Polly came up with the strangest things. All the time, said Polly. He looks at her weirdly. No, he doesn't, said Esther. Yeah, he looks at her like it's hurting his eyes. Like he's angry and sad at the same time, especially when she wears that new skirt. Well, that's a silly sort of thing to say, said Cecilia. What in the world did the child mean? If she didn't know any better, she would think that Polly was describing John Paul looking at Isabel in a sexual way. Maybe Daddy is mad with Isabel about something, said Polly, or he just feels sad that she's his daughter. Mum, do you know why Daddy is mad with Isabel? Did she do something bad? A panicky feeling rose in Cecilia's throat. He probably wanted to watch the cricket on TV, mused Polly. And Isabel wanted to watch something else. Or, I don't know. Isabel had been so grumpy lately, refusing to answer questions and slamming the door. But wasn't that what all 12-year-old girls did? Cecilia thought of those stories she'd read about sexual abuse. Stories in the Daily Telegraph, where the mother said,
I had no idea.
And Cecilia thought, how could you not know? She always finished those stories with a comfortable sense of superiority. This could not happen to my daughters. John Paul could be strangely moody at times. His face turned to granite. You couldn't reason with him. But didn't all men do that at times? Cecilia remembered how she and her mother and sister had once tiptoed around her father's moods. Not anymore. Age had mellowed him. Cecilia had assumed that would happen to John Paul one day, too. She was looking forward to it. But John Paul would never harm his daughters. This was ridiculous. This was Jerry Springer stuff. It was a betrayal of John Paul to allow the faintest shadow of doubt to cross her mind. Cecilia would stake her life on the fact that John Paul wouldn't abuse one of his daughters. But would she stake one of her daughters' lives? No. If there was the smallest risk... Dear God, what was she meant to do? Ask Isabel, has Daddy ever touched you? Victims lied. Their abusers told them to lie. She knew how it worked. She read all those trashy stories. She liked having a quick, cathartic little weep before folding up the newspaper, putting it in the recycling bin and forgetting all about it. Those stories gave her a sick sort of pleasure, whereas John Paul always refused to read them. Was that a clue to his guilt? Aha! If you don't like reading about sick people, you're sick yourself! Mum, said Polly. How could she possibly confront John Paul? Have you ever done anything inappropriate to one of our daughters? If he asked a question like that of her, she would never forgive him. How could a marriage continue when a question like that was asked? No, I haven't ever molested our daughters. Pass the peanut butter, please. Mum, said Polly again. You shouldn't have to ask, he'd say. If you don't know the answer, you don't know me. But she did know the answer. She did. But then all those other stupid mothers thought they knew the answer too. And John Paul had been so strange on the phone when she'd asked him about that letter. He had been lying about something. She was sure of it. And then there was the sex thing. Perhaps he'd lost interest in Cecilia because he was lusting after Isabel's changing young body. It was laughable. It was revolting. She felt sick. Mum! Hmm? Look, you drove right past the street. We're going to be late. Sorry. Damn it. Sorry. She slammed on her brakes to do a U-turn. There was a furious shriek of a horn from behind them, and Cecilia's heart leapt into her chest as she looked in her rear vision mirror and saw a huge truck. Shit. She raised a hand in apology. Sorry. Yes, yes, I know. The truck driver couldn't forgive her and kept his hand pressed on the horn. Sorry! Sorry! As she completed her U-turn, she looked up to wave her apology again. She had the Tupperware name emblazoned down one side of her car. She didn't want to damage the company's reputation. The driver had wound down his window and was leaning almost halfway out, his face ugly with rage as he slammed his fist over and over into the palm of his hand. Oh, for heaven's sake, she muttered. I think that man wants to kill you, said Polly. That man is very naughty, said Cecilia severely. Her heart sped as she drove sedately back to the dance studio, double-checking all her mirrors and indicating her intentions well in advance. She wound down her window and watched as Polly ran into the studio, her pink tulle tutu bobbing, her delicate shoulder blades jutting out like wings beneath the straps of her leotard. Melissa McNulty appeared at the door and waved to indicate that, as per their arrangement, she was taking care of Polly. Cecilia waved back and reversed. If this was Berlin and Caroline's office was on the other side of the wall, I wouldn't be able to go to speech therapy, said Esther. Good point, said Cecilia.
We could help her escape. We could put her in the boot of the car. She's pretty little. I think she'd fit. Unless he gets claustrophobia, like Daddy.
I feel like Caroline is the sort of person who would probably organize her own escape, said Cecilia. We've already spent enough on her. We're not going to help her escape from East Berlin.
Esther's speech therapist was intimidating with her perfect vowels. Whenever Cecilia spoke to her, she caught herself articulating all her syllables very carefully, as if she was doing an elocution test.
I don't think Daddy looks at Isabel funny, said Esther.
Don't you? Said Cecilia happily.
Good Lord, how melodramatic she was being.
Polly made one of her peculiar little observations, and Cecilia's mind jumped straight to sexual abuse. She must be watching too much trashy television.
But he was crying the other day before he went to Chicago, said Esther.
What?
In the shower, said Esther. I went into your bathroom to get the nail scissors, and Daddy was crying.
Well, darling, did you ask him why he was crying? Said Cecilia, trying not to show just how much she cared about the answer.
No, said Esther breezily. When I'm crying, I don't like to be interrupted.
Damn it, if it had been Polly, she would have pulled back the shower screen and demanded an immediate answer from her father.
I was going to ask you why Daddy was crying, said Esther, but then I forgot. I had a lot on my mind.
I really don't think he was crying. He was probably just sneezing or something, said Cecilia. The idea of John Paul crying in the shower was so foreign, so weird. Why would he be crying, except over something truly terrible? He was not a crier. When the girls were born, his eyes had got a shiny quality to them. And when his father had died unexpectedly, he'd put down the phone and made a strange, fragile noise, as if he was choking on something small and fluffy. But apart from that, she'd never seen him cry.
He wasn't sneezing, said Esther.
Maybe he had one of his migraines, said Cecilia, although she knew that whenever John Paul was afflicted by one of his debilitating migraines, the last thing he would do was have a shower. He needed to be alone, in bed, in a dark, quiet room.
Mum, Daddy never has a shower when he has a migraine, said Esther, who knew her father just as well as Cecilia knew her husband.
Depression. It seemed to be going around at the moment. At a recent dinner party, half the guests revealed they were on Prozac. After all, John Paul had always gone through patches. They often followed the migraines. There would be a week or so when it was as though he was just going through the motions. He'd say and do all the right things, but there'd be something vacant in his eyes, as if the real John Paul had checked out for a while and sent this very authentic-looking replica to take his place.
"You okay?" Cecilia would ask, and he'd always take a few moments to focus on her before saying,
"Sure, I'm fine."
But it was always temporary. Suddenly, he'd be back, fully present, listening to her and the girls with all his attention, and Cecilia would convince herself that she'd imagined the whole thing. The patches were probably just a lingering effect of the migraines.
But crying in the shower?
What did he have to cry about? Things were good at the moment.
John Paul had once tried to commit suicide. The fact floated slowly, repellently, to the surface of her mind. It was something she tried not to think about too often. It had happened when he was in his first year of university, before Cecilia had begun dating him. Apparently he'd gone off the rails for a while, and then one night he'd swallowed a bottle of sleeping pills.
His flatmate, who was meant to be visiting his parents for the weekend, had come home unexpectedly and found him. "What was going through your mind?" Cecilia had asked him when she heard the story for the first time.
"Everything felt too hard," John Paul had said. "Going to sleep forever just seemed like an easier option."
Over the years, Cecilia had often prodded him for more information about this time in his life. But why did it seem so hard? What exactly was so hard? But John Paul didn't seem capable of clarifying further.
"I guess I was just your typical anguished teenager," he'd say.
Cecilia didn't get it. She was never anguished as a teenager. Eventually, she had to give up and accept John Paul's suicide attempt as an out-of-character incident in his past.
"I just needed a good woman," John Paul told her.
It was true there had never been a serious girlfriend until Cecilia came along.
"I was honestly starting to think he might be gay," one of his brothers had confided in her once.
There was the gay thing again. But his brother had been joking. An unexplained suicide attempt in his teenage years, and now, all these years later, he was crying in the shower.
"Sometimes grown-ups have big things on their mind," said Cecilia carefully to Esther. Obviously, her first responsibility was to make sure that Esther wasn't concerned. "So I'm sure Daddy was just..."
"Hey, Mum, can I please get this book on Amazon about the Berlin Wall for Christmas?" asked Esther. "Do you want me to order it now? All the reviews are 5-star.
"No," said Cecilia. "You can borrow it from the library." God willing, they'd have escaped from Berlin by Christmas.
She turned into the parking lot underneath the speech therapist's office, wound down the window, and pressed the button on the intercom.
"Can I help you?"
"We're here to see Caroline Otto," she said. Even when she talked to the receptionist, she rounded her vowels. As she parked the car, she considered each new fact. John Paul giving Isabel strange, sad, angry looks. John Paul crying in the shower. John Paul losing interest in sex. John Paul lying about something. It was all so strange and worrying, but there was something beneath it all that was not actually unpleasant, that was in fact giving her a mild sense of anticipation. She turned off the ignition, pulled on the handbrake, and undid her seatbelt.
"Let's go," she said to Esther, and opened the car door. She knew what was giving her that little blip of pleasure. It was because she'd made a decision. Something was clearly not right. She had a moral obligation to do something immoral. It was the lesser of two evils. She was justified. As soon as the girls were in bed tonight, she would do what she'd wanted to do from the very beginning. She was going to open that goddamned letter.
Chapter 9. There was a knock at the door.
"Ignore it."
Tess's mother didn't look up from her book.
Tess, Liam, and her mother were sitting in separate armchairs in her mother's front room, reading their books with small bowls full of chocolate raisins resting on their laps. It had been one of Tess's daily routines as a child, eating chocolate raisins and reading with her mother. They always did star jumps afterward to counteract the chocolate.
"It might be Dad."
Liam put his book down. Tess was surprised at how readily he'd agreed to sit and read. It must have been the chocolate raisins. She could never get him to do his reading for school. And now, bizarrely, he was starting at a new school. Just like that. Tomorrow. It was disconcerting the way that peculiar woman had convinced him to start the very next day, with the promise of an Easter egg hunt. You spoke to your dad in Melbourne just a few hours ago, she reminded Liam, keeping her voice neutral. He and Will had talked for 20 minutes. I'll talk to Daddy later, Tess had said when Liam had held out the phone. She'd already spoken to Will once that morning. Nothing had changed. She didn't want to hear his awful, serious, new voice again. And what could she say? Mention that she'd run into an ex-boyfriend at St. Angela's? Ask if he was jealous? Connor Whitby. It must have been over 15 years since she'd seen him. They'd gone out for less than a year. She hadn't even recognized him when he'd walked into the office. He'd lost all his hair and seemed a much bigger, broader version of the man she remembered. The whole thing had been so awkward. Bad enough that she was sitting across the desk from a woman whose daughter had been murdered. Maybe Daddy got on a plane to surprise us, said Liam. There was a rap on the window right near Tess's head. I know you're all in there, said a voice. For God's sake! Tess's mother closed her book with a snap. Tess turned and saw her aunt's face pressed flat against the window, her hands cupped around her eyes so she could peer inside. Mary, I told you not to come over! Lucy's voice rocketed up several octaves. She always sounded 40 years younger when she spoke to her twin sister. Open the door! Auntie Mary rapped again on the glass. I need to talk to Tess. Tess doesn't want to talk to you. Lucy lifted her crutch and jabbed it in the air in Mary's direction. Mum, said Tess, she's my niece. I have rights. Auntie Mary tried to wrench the wooden window frame up. She has rights, snorted Tess's mother. What a load of...
But why can't she come in?
Liam's brow knitted. Tess and her mother looked at each other. They'd been so careful about what they said in front of Liam. Of course she can come in, Tess put her book to one side. Grandma was just teasing. Yes, Liam, just a silly game, cooed Lucy.
Lucy, let me in. I genuinely feel faint, shouted Auntie Mary. I'm going to faint on your precious gardenias.
Such a funny game, Lucy chuckled insanely. It reminded Tess of the ineffectual job she used to do of perpetuating the Santa Claus myth. She was the worst liar on the planet. Go let them in, Tess said to Liam. She turned to Auntie Mary at the window and pointed towards the front door. We're coming. Auntie Mary crashed off through the garden. Oops-a-daisy! I'll give you oops-a-bloody-daisy, muttered Lucy. Tess felt a sharp sense of loss at the thought that she wouldn't be able to share this story about their mothers with Felicity. It was like the real Felicity had vanished along with her old fat body. Did she exist anymore? Had she ever existed?
Darling, said Mary when Tess got to the door. And Liam, you've grown again. How does that keep happening?
Hi, Uncle Phil. Tess went to brush cheeks with her uncle, but to her surprise, he suddenly pulled her to him in an awkward hug. He said quietly into her ear, I am deeply ashamed of my daughter. Then he straightened and said, I'll keep Liam company while you girls talk. With Liam and Uncle Phil safely stashed in front of the television, Mary, Lucy and Tess sat at the kitchen table drinking tea.
I made it very clear that you weren't to show up here, said Tess's mother, who wasn't so cranky with her sister that she would forego her extremely good chocolate brownies.
Mary rolled her eyes, settled her elbows on the table, and pressed Tess's hand between her warm, plump little palms.
Sweetheart, I'm so sorry this has happened to you.
This isn't something that just happened to her, exploded Lucy.
The point is that I don't think Felicity really did have a choice, said Mary.
Oh, I didn't realize. Poor Felicity. Someone put a gun to her head, did they?
Lucy put a pretend gun to her own head. Tess wondered when her mother had last had her blood pressure checked. Mary resolutely ignored her sister and directed her conversation at Tess.
Sweetheart, you know Felicity would never have chosen for this to happen. This is torture for her.
Torture?
Is this a joke?
Lucy took a savage bite of brownie.
Do you seriously expect Tess to feel sorry for Felicity?
I just hope you can find it in your heart to forgive her. Mary was doing a wonderful job of pretending that Lucy wasn't there.
Okay, that's enough, said Lucy. I don't want to hear another word come out of your mouth.
Lucy, sometimes love just strikes, Mary finally acknowledged her sister.
It just happens, out of the blue.
Tess stared into her teacup and swirled it around. Was this actually out of the blue? Or had it always been there, right in front of her eyes? Felicity and Will had got on famously from the moment they'd met.
Your cousin is a riot,
Will had said to Tess after the three of them had been out to dinner for the first time. Tess had taken it as a compliment because Felicity was part of her. Her sparkling company was something Tess had to offer. And the fact that Will properly appreciated Felicity. Not all of her previous boyfriends had. Some had actively disliked her. Had been a huge mark in his favour. Felicity had taken an instant liking to Will, too.
You can marry this one, she'd said to Tess the next day. He's the one.
I have spoken. Did Felicity already have a crush on Will back then? Was this inevitable? Foreseeable? Tess remembered the euphoria she'd felt that day after she'd introduced Will and Felicity. It had felt like she'd reached a glorious destination, a mountaintop. He's perfect, isn't he? She'd said to Felicity. He gets us. He's the first one who really gets us. Gets us, not gets me. Her mother and aunt were still talking, oblivious to the fact that Tess wasn't contributing a word. Lucy had slapped her hand over her eyes.
This isn't some wonderful love story, Mary.
She removed her hand and shook her head in disgust at her sister, as if she was the worst kind of criminal.
What's wrong with you? Truly. What's wrong with you? Tess and Will are married, and have you forgotten there is an actual real child involved? My grandson?
But you see, they're just so desperate to somehow make it right, said Mary to Tess.
They both love you so much.
That's nice, said Tess. Over the last 10 years, Will had never once complained about the fact that Felicity spent so much time with them. Perhaps that had been a sign that Tess wasn't enough for him. What ordinary husband would be prepared to have his wife's fat cousin come along on their annual summer holiday? Unless he was in love with her. Tess was a fool not to have seen it. She'd enjoyed watching Will and Felicity banter and argue and tease each other. She'd never felt excluded. Everything was better, sharper, funnier, edgier when Felicity was around. Tess felt like she was more herself when Felicity was around because Felicity knew her better than anyone. Felicity let Tess shine. Felicity laughed the loudest at Tess's jokes. She helped define and shape Tess's personality so that Will could see Tess as she truly was. And Tess felt prettier when Felicity was around. She pressed cold fingertips to her burning cheeks. It was shameful, but true. She had never felt repelled by Felicity's obesity, but she had felt particularly slim and lithe when she stood next to her. And yet nothing had changed in Tess's mind when Felicity had lost weight. It had not occurred to her that Will would ever look at Felicity in a sexual way. She had been so sure of her position in their strange little threesome. Tess was at the apex of the triangle. Will loved her best. Felicity loved her best. How very self-centered of her.
"Tess?" said Mary.
Tess put her hand on her aunt's arm. "Let's talk about something else." Two fat tears slid snail paths down Mary's pink, powdery cheeks. Mary dabbed at her face with a crumpled tissue.
"Phil didn't want me to come. He said I'd do more harm than good. But I just thought I could find a way to make it all right. I spent all morning looking at photos of you and Felicity when you were growing up. The fun you two had together. That's the worst of this. I can't bear it if you become estranged from each other."
Tess patted her aunt's arm. Her own eyes felt dry and clear. Her heart was clenched like a fist.
"I think you might have to bear it," she said.
Chapter 10. "You're not seriously expecting me to come to a Tupperware party," Rachel had said to Marla when she'd asked her a few weeks back while they were having coffee.
"You're my best friend."
Marla stirred sugar into her soy decaf cappuccino.
"My daughter was murdered," said Rachel. "That gives me a permanent get-out-of-party card for the rest of my life."
Marla raised her eyebrows. She'd always had particularly eloquent eyebrows. Marla had the right to raise her eyebrows. Ed had been in Adelaide for work. Ed was always away for work when the two policemen turned up at Rachel's door. Marla came with Rachel to the morgue and was standing right next to her when they lifted that ordinary white bedsheet to reveal Janie's face. Marla was ready the moment Rachel's legs gave way, and she caught her instantly, expertly, one hand cupping her elbow, the other grabbing her upper arm. She was a midwife. She'd had a lot of practice catching burly husbands just before they hit the floor.
"Sorry," said Rachel.
"Janie would have come to my party," said Marla. Her eyes filled. "Janie loved me." It was true. Janie had adored Marla. She was always telling Rachel to dress more like Marla. And then, of course, on the one occasion Rachel had worn a dress that Marla had helped her buy, look what had happened. "I wonder if Janie would have liked Tupperware parties," said Rachel, as she watched a middle-aged woman arguing with her primary schooler at the table next to them. She tried and failed, as she always did, to imagine Janie as a 45-year-old woman. She sometimes ran into Janie's old friends in the shops, and it was always such a shock to see their 17-year-old selves emerge from those puffy, generic, middle-aged faces. Rachel had to stop herself from exclaiming, "Good Lord, darling, look how old you've got," in the same way that you said, "Look how tall you've grown," to children. "I remember Janie was very tidy," said Marla. "She liked to be organized. I bet she would have been right into Tupperware." The wonderful thing about Marla was that she understood Rachel's desire to talk endlessly about the sort of adult that Janie might have become, to wonder how many children she would have had, and the sort of man she would have married. It kept her alive for just those few moments. Ed had hated these hypothetical conversations so much. He'd leave the room. He couldn't understand Rachel's need to wonder what could have been, rather than just accepting that it never would be. "Excuse me, I was talking," Rachel would yell after him.
"Please come to my Tupperware party," said Marla.
"All right," said Rachel, "but just so you know, I'm not buying anything." And so here she was, sitting in Marla's living room, which was crowded and noisy with women drinking cocktails. Rachel was sandwiched on the couch in between Marla's two daughters-in-law, Eve and Arianna, who had no plans to move to New York and were both pregnant with Marla's first grandchildren.
"I'm just not into pain," Eve was telling Arianna. "I told my obstetrician, I said, 'Look, I have zero tolerance for pain. Zero. Don't even talk to me about it.'"
"Well, I guess nobody really likes pain," said Arianna, who seemed to doubt every word that came out of her mouth. "Except masochists?"
"It's unacceptable," said Eve. "In this day and age, I refuse it. I say no thank you to pain."
"Ah, so that was my mistake," thought Rachel. "I should have said no thank you to pain."
"Look who's here, ladies."
Marla appeared with a tray of sausage rolls in her hand and Cecilia Fitzpatrick by her side. Cecilia looked polished and shiny and was wheeling a neat black suitcase behind her. Apparently it was something of a coup to get Cecilia to do a party for you because she was so booked out. She had six Tupperware consultants working beneath her, according to her mother-in-law, and was sent on all sorts of overseas jaunts and the like.
"So now, Cecilia..."
Marla was flustered with responsibility, and the sausage rolls slid about on the tray in her hand.
"Would you like a drink?"
Cecilia wheeled her bag to a neat stop and rescued the sausage rolls just in the nick of time.
"Just a glass of water would be lovely, Marla," she said. "Why don't I hand these out for you while I introduce myself? Although I think I know a lot of faces, of course."
"Hello, I'm Cecilia. It's Arianna, isn't it? Sausage roll?"
Arianna looked blankly at Cecilia as she took a sausage roll. "Your younger sister teaches my daughter Polly ballet. I'm going to show you the perfect little containers for freezing purees for your baby. And Rachel, so nice to see you. How's little Jacob?"
"Moving to New York for 2 years."
Rachel took a sausage roll and gave Cecilia a wry smile. Cecilia stopped.
"Oh, Rachel, what a bugger," she said sympathetically. But then, in typical Cecilia style, she instantly shifted into solution mode.
"But listen, you'll visit, right? Someone was telling me recently about this website with amazing deals on New York apartments. I'll email you the link. Promise."
She moved on.
"Hi there, I'm Cecilia. Sausage roll?"
And on she went about the room, serving food and compliments, fixing every guest with that strange, piercing gaze of hers, so that by the time she'd finished and was ready to do her demonstration, everyone obediently swung their knees in her direction, their faces attentive, ready to be sold Tupperware, as if a firm but fair teacher had taken control of a rowdy classroom. Rachel was surprised by how much she ended up enjoying the night. It was partly the very good cocktails that Marla was serving, but it was also thanks to Cecilia, who interspersed her lively and somewhat evangelical product demonstration. "I'm a Tupperware freak," she told them. "I just love this stuff." Rachel found her genuine passion touching and compelling. It would be great if her carrots stayed crunchier for longer, with a trivia competition. Each guest who got a trivia question right was awarded a chocolate coin, a At the end of the night, the person with the most gold-wrapped coins would win a prize. Some of the questions were about Tupperware. Rachel did not know or particularly feel the need to know that a Tupperware party began somewhere in the world every 2.7 seconds.
1 second, 2 seconds, that's another Tupperware party starting, chirruped Cecilia.
Or that a man named Earl Tupper created the famous burping seal. But she did have good general knowledge, and she began to feel competitive about the growing pile of gold coins in front of her. In the end, it was a fierce battle between Rachel and Marla's friend from her midwifery days, Jenny Cruz, and Rachel actually punched her fist in the air when she won by a single gold coin on the question, "Who played Pat the Rat?" on the soapy Sons and Daughters. Rachel knew the answer, Rowena Wallace, because Janie had been obsessed with that silly show when she was a teenager. She sent up a word of thanks to Janie. She'd forgotten how much she enjoyed winning. In fact, she was on such a high that she ended up ordering over $300 worth of Tupperware that Cecilia assured her would transform her pantry and her life. By the end of the night, Rachel was a little drunk. Actually, everyone was a little drunk, except for Marla's pregnant daughters-in-law, who'd left early, and Cecilia, who was presumably drunk on the joy of Tupperware. There was much shrieking. Husbands were telephoned, lifts home were negotiated. Rachel sat on the couch, happily eating her way through her pile of chocolate coins.
"What about you, Rachel? Have you arranged a lift home?" said Cecilia, when Marla was at the front door shouting goodbyes to her tennis friends.
Cecilia had all her Tupperware packed away into her black bag and was still as immaculate as at the start of the night, except for two spots of colour high on her cheeks.
"Me?"
Rachel looked around and realised she was the last guest.
"I'm fine. I'll drive home."
For some reason, it hadn't really occurred to her that she needed to find a way to get home too. It was something to do with her sense of always feeling separate from everybody else, as if things that worried them couldn't possibly worry her, as if she was immune from the ordinariness of life.
"Don't be ridiculous,"
Marla swooped back into the room. The night had been a triumph.
"You can't drive, you crazy girl. You'd be way over the limit. Mac can drive you home. He hasn't got anything better to do."
"That's okay. I'll catch a cab." Rachel roused herself. Her head did feel fuzzy. She didn't want Mac to drive her home. Mac, who had stayed in his study throughout the Tupperware party, was a man's man and had got on great with Ed, but he was always so painfully shy in one-on-one conversations with women. It would be excruciating being alone in the car with him.
"You live down near the Wickham Road tennis courts, don't you, Rachel?"
said Cecilia. "I'll drive you home. You're right on my way." Moments later, they'd waved Marla off, and Rachel was in the passenger seat of Cecilia's white Ford Territory with the giant Tupperware logo along the side. The car was very comfortable, quiet and clean, and nice-smelling. Cecilia drove just as she did everything, capably and briskly, and Rachel put her head back against the headrest and waited for Cecilia's reliable, soothing stream of conversation about raffles, carnivals, newsletters, and everything else pertaining to St. Angela's. Instead, there was silence. Rachel glanced over at Cecilia's profile. She was chewing on her bottom lip and squinting, as if at some thought that was giving her pain. Marriage problems? Something to do with the kids? Rachel remembered all the time she used to devote to problems about sex, misbehaving children and misunderstood comments, broken appliances and money. It wasn't that she now knew those problems didn't matter. Not at all. She longed for them to matter. She longed for the tricky tussle of life as a mother and a wife. How wonderful to be Cecilia Fitzpatrick driving home to her daughters after hosting a successful Tupperware party, worrying over whatever was quite rightfully worrying her. In the end, it was Rachel who broke the silence.
"I had fun tonight," she said. "You did a great job. No wonder you're so successful at it."
Cecilia gave a small shrug. "Thank you. I love it," she smiled. "My sister makes fun of me over it."
"Jealous," said Rachel.
Cecilia shrugged and yawned. She seemed like a different person from the performer at Marla's house and the woman who zoomed around St. Angela's.
"I'd love to see your pantry," mused Rachel. "I bet everything is all labeled and in the perfect container. Mine looks like a disaster zone."
"I am proud of my pantry," Cecilia smiled. "John Paul says it's like a filing cabinet of food. I make a big song and dance if the poor girls put something back in the wrong spot."
"How are your girls?" asked Rachel.
"Wonderful," said Cecilia, although Rachel saw a shadow of a frown. "Growing up fast. Giving me cheek."
"Your eldest daughter," said Rachel. "Isabel. I saw her the other day in assembly. She reminds me a little of my daughter. Of Jamie."
Cecilia didn't respond.
"Why did I tell her that?" thought Rachel. "I must be drunker than I realize. No woman wanted to hear that her daughter looked like a girl who'd been strangled." But then, Cecilia said, with her eyes on the road ahead, "I have just one memory of your daughter."
Chapter 11. "I have just one memory of your daughter." Was it the right thing to do? What if she made Rachel cry? She'd just won the Heat and Eat Every Day set, and she seemed so happy about it. Cecilia had never been comfortable around Rachel. She felt trivial, because surely the whole world was trivial to a woman who had lost a child in such circumstances. She always wanted to somehow convey to Rachel that she knew she was trivial. Years ago, she'd seen something on a TV talk show about how grieving parents appreciated hearing people tell them memories of their children. There would be no more new memories, so it was a gift to share one with them. Ever since then, whenever Cecilia saw Rachel, she thought of her memory of Janie, paltry though it was, and wondered how she could share it with her. But there was never an opportunity. You couldn't bring it up in the school office in between conversations about the uniform shop and the netball timetable. Now was the perfect time. The only time. And Rachel was the one who had brought up Janie. "Of course, I didn't actually know her at all," said Cecilia. "She was 4 years ahead of me. But I do have this memory." She faltered.
"Go on."
Rachel straightened in her seat. "I love to hear memories of Janie." "Well, it's just something really small," said Cecilia. Now she was terrified she wouldn't deliver enough. She wondered if she should embellish. "I was in year 2. Janie was in year 6. I knew her name because she was house captain of Red." "Ah, yes." Rachel smiled. "We dyed everything red. One of Ed's work shirts accidentally got dyed red. Funny how you forget all that stuff." "So it was the school carnival, and do you remember how we used to do marching? Each house had to march around the oval. I'm always telling Connor Whitby that we should bring back the marching. He just laughs at me." Cecilia glanced over and saw that Rachel's smile had withered a little. She ploughed on. Was it too upsetting? Not that interesting? I was the sort of child who took the marching very seriously. and I desperately wanted Red to win. But I tripped over, and because I fell, all these other children crashed into the back of me. Sister Ursula was screaming like a banshee, and that was the end of it for Red. I was sobbing my heart out. I thought it was the absolute end of the world. And Janie Crowley, your Janie, came over and helped me up and brushed off the back of my uniform, and she said very quietly in my ear, "It doesn't matter. It's only stupid marching." Rachel didn't say anything. "That's it," said Cecilia humbly. "It wasn't much, but I just always..." "Thank you, darling," said Rachel. And Cecilia was reminded of an adult thanking a child for a homemade bookmark made out of cardboard and glitter. Rachel lifted a hand as if she was about to wave at someone, and then she let it brush gently against Cecilia's shoulder before dropping it in her lap. "That's just so Janie. Only stupid marching. You know what? I think I remember it. All the children tumbling to the ground. Marla and I giggling our heads off." She paused. Cecilia's stomach tensed. Was she about to burst into tears? "Gosh, you know, I am a tiny bit drunk," said Rachel. "I actually thought about driving myself home. Imagine if I'd killed someone." "I'm sure you wouldn't have," said Cecilia. "I really did have fun tonight," said Rachel. Her head was turned so that she was addressing the car window. She gently knocked her forehead against the window. It seemed like something a much younger woman would do after they'd had too much to drink. "I should make the effort to go out more often." "Oh, well," said Cecilia. This was her thing. She could fix that. "You must come to Polly's birthday party the week after Easter. Saturday afternoon at 2. It's a pirate party." "That's very nice of you, but I'm sure Polly doesn't need me crashing her party," said Rachel. "You must come. You'll know lots of people. John Paul's mother, my mum. Lucy O'Leary is coming with Tess and her little boy, Liam." Cecilia was suddenly desperate for her to come. "You could bring your grandson. Bring Jacob. The girls would love to have a toddler there." Rachel's face lit up. "I did say I'd look after Jacob while Rob and Lauren are seeing real estate agents about renting out their house while they're in New York. Oh, this is me. Just ahead." Cecilia stopped the car in front of a red brick bungalow. It seemed like every light in the house had been left on. "Thanks so much for the lift." Rachel climbed out of the car with the same careful sideways slide of the hips as Cecilia's mother. There was a certain age, Cecilia had noticed, before people stooped or trembled, where they didn't seem to trust their bodies as they once had. "I'll send an invitation to you at the school." Cecilia leaned across the seat to call out the window, wondering if she should be offering to walk Rachel to the door. Her own mother would be insulted if she did. John Paul's mother would be insulted if she didn't. "Lovely," said Rachel, and she walked off briskly, as if she'd read Cecilia's thoughts and wanted to prove she wasn't elderly just yet. "Thanks very much." Cecilia turned the car around in the cul-de-sac, and by the time she came back, Rachel was already inside, the front door pulled firmly shut. Cecilia looked for her silhouette through the windows, but didn't see anything. She tried to imagine what Rachel was doing now and what she was feeling, alone in a house with the ghosts of her daughter and her husband. Well, she had a slightly breathless feeling as if she'd just driven home a minor celebrity. And she'd talked to her about Janie. It had gone pretty well, she thought. She'd given Rachel a memory, just like the magazine article said she should. She felt a mild sense of social achievement, and a satisfaction in finally ticking off a long-procrastinated task. And then she felt ashamed for feeling pride, or any sort of pleasure, in connection to Rachel's tragedy. She stopped at a traffic light and remembered the angry truck driver from that afternoon, and with that thought, her own life came flooding back into her mind. While she'd been driving Rachel home, she'd temporarily forgotten everything. The strange things Polly and Esther had said about John Paul today in the car, her decision to open his letter tonight. Did she still feel justified? Everything had seemed so ordinary after speech therapy. There had been no more peculiar revelations from her daughters, and Isabel had seemed especially cheerful after her haircut. It was a short pixie cut, and from the way Isabel was holding herself, it was clear that she thought it made her look very sophisticated, when it actually made her look younger and sweeter. There had been a postcard for the girls from John Paul in the letterbox. He had a running joke with his daughters where he sent them the silliest postcards he could find. Today's postcard featured one of those dogs with folds of wrinkly skin, wearing a tiara and beads, and Cecilia thought it was stupid. But, true to form, the girls all fell about laughing and put it on the fridge. "Oh, come on now," she said mildly as a car suddenly pulled into the lane in front of her. She lifted her hand to toot the horn and then didn't bother. "Note how I didn't scream and yell like a mad person," she thought for the benefit of that afternoon's psychotic truck driver, just in case he happened to have stopped by to read her mind. It was a cab in front of her. He was doing that weird cabby thing of testing the brakes every few seconds. Oh, great. He was heading the same direction as her. The cab jerked its way down her street and, without warning, suddenly stopped at the curb outside Cecilia's house. The lights in the cab went on. The passenger was sitting in the front seat. One of the Kingston boys, thought Cecilia. The Kingstons lived across the road and had three sons in their 20s still living at home, using their expensive private educations to do never-ending degrees and get drunk in city bars. "If a Kingston boy ever goes near one of our girls," John Paul always said, "I'll be ready with the shotgun." She pulled into her driveway, pressed the button on the remote for the garage, and looked in her rear-vision mirror. The cabbie had popped the boot. A broad-shouldered man in a suit was pulling out his luggage. It wasn't a Kingston boy. It was John Paul. He always looked so unfamiliar when she saw him unexpectedly like this in his work clothes, as if she was still 23 and he'd gone and got all grown up and grey-haired without her. John Paul was home 3 days early. She was filled with equal parts pleasure and exasperation. She'd lost her chance. She couldn't open the letter now. She turned off the ignition, pulled on the handbrake, undid her seatbelt, opened the car door, and ran down the driveway to meet him.
Chapter 12. "Hello," said Tess warily, looking at her watch as she picked up her mother's home phone. It was 9 o'clock at night. Surely it couldn't be another telemarketer. "It's me." It was Felicity. Tess's stomach cramped. Felicity had been calling all day on her mobile, leaving voicemail messages and texts that Tess left unheard and unread. It felt strange, ignoring Felicity, as if she was forcing herself to do something unnatural. "I don't want to talk to you." "Nothing has happened," said Felicity. "We still haven't slept together." "For God's sake," said Tess. And then, to her surprise, she laughed. It wasn't even a bitter laugh. It was a genuine laugh. This was ridiculous. What's the hold-up? But then she caught sight of herself in the mirror above her mother's dining room table and saw her smile fade, like someone catching on to a cruel trick. "All we can think about is you," said Felicity. And Liam. The bed stuff website crashed. Anyway, I won't talk to you about work. I'm at my apartment. Will is at home. He looks like a wreck. You're pathetic.
Tess turned away from her reflection in the mirror. You're both so pathetic.
I know, said Felicity.
Her voice was so low, Tess had to press the phone hard against her ear to hear her.
I'm a bitch. I'm that woman we hate.
Speak up, said Tess irritably.
I said I'm a bitch, repeated Felicity.
Don't expect any argument from me.
I don't, said Felicity. Of course I don't.
There was silence.
You want me to be all right with it, said Tess. She knew them so well.
Don't you? You want me to make everything all right.
That was her job. That was her role in their three-way relationship. Will and Felicity were the ones who ranted and raved, who let the clients upset them, who got their feelings hurt by strangers, who thumped the steering wheel and shouted, "Are you kidding me?" It was Tess's job to soothe them, to jolly them along, to do the whole glass is half full, it will all work out, you'll feel better in the morning thing. How could they possibly have an affair without her there to help? They needed Tess there to say, it's not your fault.
I don't expect that, said Felicity. I don't expect anything from you.
Are you all right? Is Liam all right?
We're fine, said Tess. She felt an overwhelming tiredness, and with it came an almost dreamy sense of detachment. These huge swoops of emotion were exhausting. She pulled out one of the dining room table chairs and sat down. Liam is starting at St. Angela's tomorrow. Watch me getting on with my life.
Tomorrow? What's the rush?
There's an Easter egg hunt.
Ah, said Felicity. Chocolate. Liam's kryptonite. He's not being taught by any of the psychotic nuns who taught us, is he?
Tess thought, don't you chat with me, as if everything is normal. But for some reason she went on talking anyway. She was too tired, and it was too ingrained in her psyche. She chatted to Felicity every day of her life. She was her best friend. She was her only friend. The nuns are all dead, she said, but the PE teacher is Connor Whitby. Remember him?
Connor Whitby, repeated Felicity. He was that sad, sinister guy you were going out with before we came to Melbourne. But I thought he was an accountant.
He retrained.
He wasn't sinister, was he? Said Tess. Hadn't he been perfectly nice?
He was the boyfriend who had loved her hands. She remembered that suddenly. How strange. She'd been thinking about him last night, and now he'd reappeared in her life.
He was sinister, said Felicity definitely. He was really old, too.
He was 10 years older than me.
Anyway, I remember